Andrew Hudson is my guest today on the Scholars Podcast. He's a 2005 John Monash Foundation Scholar. He has honours in both politics and law and a Master's of Law. Andrew has just returned home from New York City, where he has spent the last 16 years in the United States. And he's joining us from Melbourne today. Andrew, welcome back to Australia.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be home.
So you've come back to Australia and no doubt you've had to endure 2 weeks of hard lockdown. Tell us about that experience.
Well, yeah, we have three young kids, 1, 3, and 5, and I was very worried about spending 2 weeks in a hotel room.
that had potential to be trouble.
Yes, absolutely. We got very lucky. My first piece of advice to any other John Monash scholar coming home is quarantine in Sydney. The program up there is fabulous. We got a really good apartment.
Is that right? Yeah.
We got a really good apartment with balconies and fresh air and a treadmill. And so we could get anything delivered we wanted to and lots of fresh air. I was actually very impressed we were literally met by the army getting off the plane.
Is that what happens? You get off and it's like, come here, please.
Yeah, they grab your bags and put them all on a bus. We had our own bus for our family of five going to our hotel. And the whole program is extremely smoothly run. So yeah, look, I don't want to sound like I joke that my wife got Stockholm syndrome because she said, "Oh, this is fabulous," and I was like, "No, definitely wasn't fabulous."
I'm doing lockdown again. This is great.
It was not fabulous, but it wasn't as bad as I expected.
Yeah. Okay. And were you would have been worried about it, knowing that you were coming home and just thought,
yeah. Oh, I mean, it was, you know, the financial cost and stress associated with coming home was huge. I mean, probably the worst aspect of the pandemic, I would say, for us, and we can probably talk more about this. It might be a big statement coming from someone that was in New York, but, you know, it cost us the best part of $40,000 to come home.
Stop it.
I mean, it's just obscene.
No.
That's
the airfares, right? I would think.
Yeah, and then also the cost of quarantine. Yeah. But, you know, and then not knowing when you're going to get home. And we had a flight booked into Melbourne and, you know, the airport was closed. We didn't know when it was going to reopen. For weeks, we thought it was going to reopen in time. And then 2 weeks beforehand, we had to make a decision, you know, well, it doesn't look like it's going to open in time. So we had to change flights to fly into Sydney. And just the stress of not knowing when to get in, whether we were going to get in, the stress of having to spend an enormous amount of, you know, life savings. And then the stress of knowing we had to quarantine for 2 weeks. It was definitely, you know, an unpleasant time, but then coming out of quarantine all the more euphoric.
So you forget about all of that. Well, hopefully. Are there many on the plane coming home?
No, I mean, each plane is limited to 25 people. So that's the Australian federal government.
Plenty of
regulation. So yeah, it is obscene again that you have these planes flying with the carbon footprint that plane has like that and everything
25
else.
25 people.
For 25 people, yeah, there's got to be a better way, one would think.
So, let's go to your time in the United States. I'll let you describe what you were doing there. What was your job?
Yeah, well, so I had 16 years in the United States with quite a few different things going on. So when I first went over with the John Monash Scholarship, that enabled me to study at New York University School of Law, which is the best law school for human rights in the world, which is, you know, what I've always done.
Yes.
Had a great time there working with all sorts of fabulous people, including Philip Holston, probably Australia's leading international human rights expert. Mm-hmm. I came out of my master's at NYU and worked for an organization called the International Center for Transitional Justice, one of the leading kind of human rights organizations. And then went to work for Human Rights First for 5 years. That organization used to be called the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. Again, one of the leading kind of international human rights organizations that did a lot of work on Latin America. And then for the last 11 years, I've worked at Crisis Action. So I've been the CEO of Crisis Action for the last 6 years. Crisis Action is a fabulous organization.
Tell us about it. What is Crisis Action?
So the mandate is to protect civilians in war zones, to prevent conflict, to resolve conflict, to stop mass atrocities in places like Syria, Yemen, South Sudan. And what's unusual about the organization is we work entirely behind the scenes. So we're sometimes called the most effective organization you've never heard of. And so that's by design.
Like
so,
a good spin doctor, just right. Staying out of the limelight. Yeah.
Or maybe an orchestra conductor, yes. Or the cox in a rowing boat. So those sorts of analogies. We will bring together, local human rights activists from Syria, get them to brief the UN Security Council, get them onto the front page of the New York Times, get them to really change government policy in a particular war zone. But you won't hear about us anywhere because we don't want to detract from the authenticity and the legitimacy and the power of those different voices. So, yeah, when I joined Crisis Action...
And presumably, Andrew, staying out of the limelight, that's precisely the way you like to run things.
Well, right. That's the power of this model, isn't it? That basically we can, in that orchestra conductor role, we can decide which voice is going to be the most powerful in a given moment. Is it amplifying the voices of religious leaders? Is it amplifying the voice of the private sector? Is it amplifying voices from the ground? And so really, it's a very, very, very powerful model. And staying out of the limelight means that those people trust us. Mm. And it means that those voices can really cut through to the halls of power.
And so tell us about some of the work that you can, that you did at Crisis Action.
Yeah, well, and I think what was great is that when I joined Crisis Action 11 years ago, we were about 8 people. We're now almost 60 people in 12 countries. A really once-in-a-lifetime dream job to run a globally complex organization that's having massive impact. To run through a couple of examples, we helped to secure a UN peacekeeping force in Central African Republic, which we now know has saved thousands of lives. We helped to secure a breakthrough first ever agreement for the UN to send aid convoys across borders into Syria, which reached 3 million starving Syrians, and that was extremely groundbreaking because the UN would never normally contravene the sovereignty of an individual state.
Yes. How do you go about doing something like that? That's got to be more than, boots on the ground and phone calls. There has to be a lot of logistical barriers to overcome.
Yeah, well, that was a 6-month global campaign where we were coordinating hundreds of different organizations and voices. So obviously work at the UN Security Council in New York to target, the UN Security Council missions and ambassadors, but then also work in the regions, right, where those governments are, because we have offices all around the world. So whether it was the Middle East or Africa or even China and Russia, which were key kind of blockers on this. So, really trying to pull out all the stops to do media work, to do policymaker meetings. So sort of extensive campaigning and advocacy.
Did you do a lot of international travel as part of your role there?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we had offices in about 12 countries. So I was, the pre-COVID life, I was
traveling. Yeah, there'd be a lot of frequent fly points.
Yeah, although working for a not-for-profit, we always travel discount economy. So very hard to now get frequent flyer points. Yeah, okay. But I was usually traveling twice a month and not just traveling, Canberra to Sydney, but traveling New York to Nairobi,
different feel.
So, it was such a great job. I got to brief the UN Security Council. I got to brief Congress in the US.
Briefing the UN?
It was great. All of these different settings look different. They depend on the meeting and, you know, who's there and all that sort of stuff. But the main UN Security Council meetings that I was briefing on was quite a few years ago on the Lord's Resistance Army, which was Joseph Kony and his cronies in Central Africa, this feared terrorist group that would mutilate and hack people to death and abduct hundreds at a time. Mm. And so, yeah, I had the great privilege of addressing the council with two amazing religious leaders from Congo, who were, you know, sort of giving their life story and experience of this terrorist organization. And I then came in to provide some of the recommendations about what the UN Security Council should do. But yeah, it's a lot of fun forging these relationships with diplomats over many years. It was a really fun time.
And Congress, what was that like?
Yeah, so Congress is very different, right? Like the UN Security Council is the most international global experience, and then US Congress is the most narrow and parochial and American experience.
Yeah.
But I addressed a couple of different commissions and committees there. They have a human rights commission, which is very kind of, you know, which has the most progressive members of Congress.
Yeah.
And then they have various different committees on the different regions of the world as well. So I was mainly briefing on Latin America and Guatemala and Congress and getting the US Congress to actually set up this amazing initiative, this International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, which has now sent two or three former presidents to jail. And so the US funding of that at the start was instrumental.
Were you ever in a situation in your job where you're overseas in a hot spot, so to speak, and you thought, "Ooh, this is a little bit dangerous. This is a bit hairy. I'm not entirely certain I'm comfortable here."
Oh yeah, many times. In various different jobs throughout my career. I mean, I remember way back when I was with the UN Refugee Commission. So I actually worked for them for a year after uni in Australia, and we were on the border between Ecuador and Colombia when the war in Colombia was pretty hot. And there were some times there where, it was very tense because the FARC guerrillas were coming into towns. They often talk about the fog of war. I mean, you know, when you watch things on TV, it all looks very clear cut, right? What's going on? Actually, when you're in it, you have no idea where is the war. You don't know where the war is. You don't really know where the front line is.
Mm.
It's just all of a sudden stuff starts happening. It's a lot of chant, there's a lot of whispers. And yeah, that was one example. But I would say Congo was definitely kind of the most hair raising. Democratic Republic of Congo is a very lawless country. And I spent a bit of time in the east, in places near Goma, and again there were different kind of terrorist organizations roaming, and in fact the main kind of rebel leader would drive up and down the street in a very large ute with three goons on the back with an enormous bazooka, in fact two bazookas. And they would just roam up and down the streets. And these guys were often on all sorts of different drugs, and I mean just the whole scene was pretty crazy. But most people just getting on with their life as normal, and that's what's amazing, right, is that civilians that live in these war zones are so resilient and so courageous and so brave. It's really, really quite extraordinary.
And I imagine there'd be times where you're on the plane, you know, you've wheels up, you've just left, thinking, "Well, I'm glad I'm out of there."
Well, funny you should mention this. So, wheels up, yes, I was actually leaving Congo Kinshasa, very, very happy to be leaving. I took a sleeping pill just before, as we were taxiing really down the runway, put the eye mask on, I'm waiting for wheels up, and wheels up doesn't come, and I look in the cabin, I'm like, is that sort of smoke I can smell? Long story short, the plane had run into a mound of dirt on the runway. We returned back to Kinshasa. My sleeping pill started kicking in hard, and we then roamed the streets for about from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. trying to find a hotel. And I'm like, under the effects of this hallucinogenic Ambien hardcore sleeping tablet, barely able to think.
You know, speak.
So yeah, wait for wheels up. Yes.
And so how did you get involved in all of this? So you've obviously had a thread of human rights flowing through you for a long time of your professional career, all of it. Where did your interest in human rights first begin?
Yeah, I would say human rights, international affairs. You know, from a very young age, I've always been fascinated by the world and this kind of arbitrary distinction of national borders. And so at high school, I was very involved in the UN Youth Association.
And where was high school for you? That was in Melbourne?
Yes, it was. The small, quaint little school of Scotch College. So I ended up being national president of the UN Youth Association, and then actually ended up being Australia's first youth representative to the United Nations in New York in the 90s.
Okay. Wow.
And so from a very young age, you know, even at school, I was, you know, very involved in international affairs and UN issues, things like that.
Why do you think it was, though, that passion was there?
Yeah, I mean, I think my dad likes to say that, of course, he was responsible for it all, as all good parents do.
Yeah,
they took me out of school in grade one, and we spent, I think, about 6 months traveling the world, and not just going to like London, Paris, but going to Thailand, Egypt, India.
Okay, all right, yes.
And so, you know, I think getting a real feel from a young age what the rest of the developing world looks like, I think that must have happened. That must have helped at some level. But, you know, I think I've just always been fascinated in human well-being, you know. And it sort of seems strange. I often think it's really weird that why do people ask me why I'm interested in this, and yet no one says, why are you interested in only maximizing profit? Which is, of course, the motivation for 80% of the jobs in any country. I feel like we've got
great
it
answer.
The way, right?
Great
it's
answer.
Just really bizarre. Like, why are you interested in maximizing money? It makes no sense to me.
And I think you've definitely forged a career in helping people.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, there is no better, you know, often people say, oh, well, it's so, you know, altruistic, you know, and in the sense it is. I mean, I've obviously, you look at my peers earning millions of dollars a year. I mean, I could have earned a lot more money, having worked in the non-for-profit sector the whole time, but the kick and the, incredible, highs that I get from the work helping people is immeasurable, right? So, you know, that is a bit of a drug, right? Like, it really does feel
you're an addict.
Great to be, you know, empowering other people to be making a difference, to be making an impact in the world.
And so, obviously, it's been a very hard decision, I imagine, for you to wrap all of that up and move the family back to Australia. What was the motivation behind it's time we saw a bit of the home country?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, it's funny, I've just come off this interview with Radio National where we talked about this very topic, and this organisation Advance has been doing a lot of research into why the Australian diaspora comes home. And, you know, I think that the general reasons are, and these all apply to me, you want your kids to have an Australian childhood. You want to spend more time with your parents.
Yes.
You want the Australian lifestyle. And especially, obviously, now in this global pandemic, you know, the lucky country really is ringing very true at the moment, isn't it? I mean, I think we've now had 500,000 Australians have returned to live in Australia. So, you know, right now, obviously the pandemic is the main driver of that, to come home and live in this fantastically free and healthy society is fabulous. But yeah, I mean, we were always wanting to come home. We've been 16 years in New York. It was time for us to come home. Yeah, the pandemic sped that up a little bit, but we still had, you know, at least over a year to plan that return home. But we're just very, very, very happy to be home.
What was it like? And answer this however you like. So I'm interested in your observations as an Australian living, working, raising a family in New York, one during the outbreak, the hard outbreak of the coronavirus, COVID, and also the Trump years, living through Donald Trump's presidency. What are your observations?
Well, the two go hand in hand, don't they? We had our third child on the day that the WHO declared the virus a global pandemic.
Oh. Very memorable.
Very memorable. And, you know, this was in March last year, and the virus was rampaging through the city.
Yes, it was.
But no one really knew. But no one really knew because there was no testing at that stage. Just lots of people getting sick, and it was a bit, you know. A week after we left hospital, our ward was turned into a COVID ward. The pediatric ward was converted into a COVID ward. So, you know, those early days were scary because no one knew what was happening, right? I think we've all now got so accustomed to the virus. But back then, no one had any idea what was going on because there was no testing, which was, of course, because Donald Trump didn't believe it was real and because he disbanded the pandemic's infrastructure and hadn't invested in testing. So it was scary. It was scary in those initial days. But you know, I think it was not as scary as most Australians thought, seeing the news each day in New York of body bags and all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, living in New York City, I didn't see the body bags, right? Like, unless you go into the hospital, which I didn't do, you're not going to see that. Our life was, and we never had a lockdown in New York. There was never a lockdown. The governor famously refused to call it a lockdown. And in fact,
it sounds very strange now. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you could get on a plane any day we could have got on a plane to go anywhere in the US or even internationally any day we wanted to. We could have rented a car on any day. We could have stayed in an Airbnb anywhere. We never were confined to our apartment for any, like, duration of time or anything like that. So, you know, in a sense, I felt like we were lucky because we never had the lockdown that Melbourne had, for instance. You know, it's very, very different. And everyone's experience of this pandemic is different. And then to return to the second half of your question, the Trump years, you know, I think just incredibly depressing, right? I mean, just, you know, the impression that has left with, or during the time, the culture that created of dividing the country so badly, you know, the divisiveness was palpable walking down the street.
Really?
You know, and of course that then, you know, came across into the pandemic, right? So if you were not wearing a face mask, you were a Trump supporter and a bad person, and I will spit on your face, you know, like metaphorically. You know, just those little social cues, right? Like if you wore a red cap, you were a bad human being that deserved to be kicked, you know.
Awful.
And then for people of color and for women and for minorities and disadvantaged communities, it was a living nightmare, you know, that you had the most powerful person in the world telling you that you were the problem, that you were responsible for problems, when of course it's exactly the other way around. You know, it was a really troubling time. And then to see, you know, such a buffoon and, you know, megalomaniacal narcissist then at the helm during the largest crisis to hit the world in the last couple of decades. I mean, you know, imagine Hillary Clinton had been president of the US and how different the world would look right now. I believe it would look so different. I believe the virus would have been brought under control much more quickly. I believe many fewer lives would have been lost. There are very real consequences for electing a person like that into power.
He's talking about coming back, you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't doubt that he will. And I think the thing is that people often think that he's the cause and he's not, he's the consequence, right? Mm. He only got into power because he was tapping into a sentiment in America that's very real. We spent our last 3 months in Montana. And you know, there are large swathes of the country that have been left behind by globalization, that yes. have not been brought along in the experiment of liberalization, that don't really kind of ever really understood democracy or whatever, and are very skeptical of government. And so, you know, it is not, Donald Trump is not the problem. The problem is that American society has failed millions and millions of people who are feeling extremely disenchanted, marginalized, however you want to describe it. So that is the problem that the US needs to fix. And I think Joe Biden, to his credit, is really trying to do that.
Mm. Bring both sides of the aisle together, trying to.
Yep. Right. Trying to. Yep.
So I know you've landed a fresh job in Australia. I'm not sure if you've started it yet, but tell us about what you'll be doing next.
Yeah, well, I spent the last 5 or 6 months having many conversations with people. I probably had 100 conversations with people back in Australia, getting their advice about how to return to Australia. And I think, again, for others that are thinking about coming home, it's so important to do that. You know, I had so many people to say, just wait till you get home. Definitely don't wait until you get home. Really important to start those conversations 6 months in advance. I got so much great advice about how to market my skills, about how to be, you know, a little bit modest about what I've achieved, so as not to activate the kind of Australian tall poppy syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Which is very real.
Which is very real, right. How to, you know, really talk about the transferability of skills. And so, I actually really enjoyed those conversations, and I actually felt a lot of support and receptivity. I applied for some jobs and didn't get those.
Yep.
And then I also had probably two or three organizations that after, you know, those sort of 5 months of conversations wanted to create a position for me, which was lovely.
Wow, that's always nice.
So I've taken a position at the Center for Policy Development in Melbourne, which is a fabulous policy institute that's really trying to connect and convince Australian government across a range of policy areas to make Australia a better country. And so I'll be working with them to create a new international division.
Okay. Well, let's give them a plug. So what do they do?
Yeah. So they're a policy institute that does research. So create, connect, convince is their motto. Mm-hmm. So the create bit is coming up with great policy ideas. You know, government is usually too preoccupied with short-term policy ideas. So CPD comes up with longer-term policy ideas across a range of different areas. So whether that's climate change or education or economic growth or making the economy more innovative. And they then connect, they bring the right people together to socialize these ideas and then convince, they then engage, in advocacy to convince government, usually on the via kind of insider means, to adopt these policies and ensure that they're implemented. So most of CPD's work has been domestically focused.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be starting sort of a new international program
for
them to look at what's going on in the region. They already do work on human trafficking. I'd love to do some work potentially on climate change in the Pacific Islands. I'd love to do some work on Myanmar. But these are just ideas out there. I'm very grateful that they've enabled me to have a couple of months off, which I really need to have a break after my job at Crisis Action and to help set the family up. We've got a new house. We've got to get kids into school. So I'll be starting in June, which will come around all too quickly.
It will.
But yeah.
You've got a month to, you know, get your golf game in order and whatever.
I haven't had a chance to play golf, but maybe I'll put that on the bucket list. Yeah. But it's been a lot more trips to the Tip and Bunnings and IKEA than I would like.
Yeah. They'll get to know you. They go, oh, he's back.
Yes. They've stopped asking for my ID at the Tip. They're like, yeah, yeah. Flat cardboard boxes. Okay, off you go.
Or Bunnings. Yeah, oh, that's barbecue sauce that he prefers, not the tomato sauce. Well, welcome home. I think it's terrific that you're back in Australia, and thank you very much for joining us today, Andrew Hudson. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, and we look forward to following your success in the years ahead. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks very much. Bye for now.